We're holding on Memdalid Omud Beis, six lines from the bottom. We've been talking about the din where if a yid sells an eved kanani to another yid in chutz la'aretz, then we said we penalize him and we force that the eved should be freed. So now actually we need to figure out who is it that's penalized. Is it that the original owner has to pay money to free him? He has to reimburse the other guy and then free him, or is it that the second guy has to free him without getting reimbursed? So Omer of Onan, Shamis Minei Demar Shmuel Tarti. So Rav Onan says, I heard two halachas from Shmuel. Chodahach, one of them was in connection with our Mishnah about the person who sells an eved to someone in Chutz La'aretz. The idach, and the other one was the other one. And then once he explains to both of them that he's going to say that that there's a connection between the two of them, where one of them we say that he has to reimburse the money and the other not. And Rav Onan says, I'm not sure which is which. So the second din was the itmar hamolcho sadeo b'shnase yovel atzma. If a person sells his field during yovel itself, now we know, of course, a person sells his field before yovel in Eretz Yisrael, then it returns to him in yovel. So now what happens is in yovel year itself, he sells the field. So Rav Omer mechor of yotzer. So Rav says it is a valid sale, and but it immediately goes out of his possession. So in other words, the guy who bought it has forfeited his money. He doesn't get his money reimbursed. Shmuel says it's not sold at all, meaning in other words that so therefore on the face of it would mean that he has to get reimbursed. And in fact, Rashi says there's a kavul chomer. Any field that was already sold goes back to its owner. How much more so this field that is first being sold now shouldn't even leave its owner's possession in the first place. So now Rav Onan says these two dinim, that and as far as the eved, v'chodra hadri zvini or v'chodra lehadri zvini. In one of them, Shmuel said that the sale gets undone, meaning in other words that the money gets reimbursed. And in one of them not, meaning that the buyer lost his money. But Rav Onan says, I don't know which is which. I know I learned these two dinim, but I'm not sure which one do we say that he gets back his money and which one not. So Omer Rav Yosef, Nech Zianan. So Rav Yosef says, listen, let's try to figure it out. We'll try to figure out logically. Midatoni bebraisa, given that you have a braisa that says that we learned yesterday, Hamoicha Abdel Chutzlaritz Yotzel Cheus, Vitzorach get Shichru Merabo Sheni. We said he goes free, but he needs to get Shichru from the second master. Shmamina Kanye Rabo Sheni. That implies, therefore, that the second one did actually acquire him. It was considered a valid sale. Otherwise, how does the second one have any authority to be able to write a get Shichru for him? But therefore the money would not get returned. So in other words, it was a valid sale. However, once the sale goes through, then the chachamim penalize him and tell him he has to free the eved. So therefore, it must be in the other case regarding the one who sells the field in Yovel year itself. That must be when Shmuel, if you're telling me, Rav Onan, that in one of those cases, Shmuel said you reimburse the money and the other one don't, then it must be that the one that he's saying that when you sell a field in Yovel, then that would be buy a field that the money gets reimbursed and Umois Choser and the money gets reimbursed and that we consider that the sale was never valid in the first place. So that must be the answer, said Rav Yosef. So the question is, well, why does Rav Onan not know that answer himself? The answer is Rav Onan, Braisa Leishmili. Rav Onan had not heard of this Braisa. We expect the Chachamim to know all the Mishnayos. We don't expect them to know all the Braises. You're going to say that you don't maybe need the braisa. The very fact that Shmuel says by the field that was sold in Yovel, ain't a mechora, it's not sold, doesn't that imply that there was no valid sale at all? Not necessarily, says Rav Onan, mimai de ain't a mechora mois chozrin, because how would you know that it means that it's not sold and therefore the money has to be returned, that it's considered there was no sale at all? Duma ain't a mechora mois matonan inu. We could equally well say, says Rav Onan, we could have understood Shmuel to be saying, yes, it's not a valid sale, but the money is considered to be a gift. In other words, because so when we say it's not sold, would mean, for example, so it's not sold, not only that he has to return it, it would mean, for example, let's say that it can't be used as a basis for Kinyan Agav. We're going to learn in Kedushin in a few months, Bez Hashem, that there's such a thing, it's mentioned sporadically here in other places in Chas, that you have such a thing called Kinyan Agav. You can sell somebody a field and Agav it. You tell them, by the way, together with that field, you're also acquiring certain metalplin. And that works even though no particular act of Kinyan was done on those metalplin, because the land is bought with money and therefore the metalplin go with it as well. So fine, Shmuel might say, Einem Achura, in the sense it's not even sold as far as that. So even the metalplin that was sold along with it are not considered that they were bought, and a separate kinyan is needed for those. But still, he could still say the money is still considered a matona and it doesn't need to be returned. Midi to have a makadish as a choisoi, because it would be similar to the case where a person is makadish's sister. Now, of course, kedushin doesn't work by a sister; it's an iser arayas, and as we learned in Yevamos, kedushin are not tofus anytime there's an iser kores, which is the case with a sister or missus based in. So the money is definitely not kedushin, and the itmar, where in fact we have a discussion between Rav and Shmuel, what happens in that case. I'm a kaddish as a choisei. Rav omer mois choisvin. Rav says the money would have to be returned, because given that he knows he can't be Makadish's sister, then it means that maybe at most he's giving it to her as a pikodin. He's having her watch the money for him for the time being, but not that he's planning to give it to her permanently. Or Shmuel Amar Mois Matona. Shmuel says no, in that case the money is actually considered a gift, because again he knows that kedushin are not tofus, so therefore he has in mind to give it to her outright. So given that Shmuel holds in that case that the money stays with her outright, by the same token, Shmuel might well have said, in the case of the field sold in Yovel, that just because it's not a sale doesn't mean the money has to be returned. Maybe he's allowed to keep the money. Maybe it's the same as a man being Makadish's sister. And therefore, so that's why Rav Onan wasn't sure. Rav Yosef is telling us on the basis of a Braisa, so Rav Onan had not known of that Braisa. And even if therefore he would have said that just from Shmuel's words itself, we don't know the answer. Once we have the Braisa, then yeah, that clarifies things for us. Tosfos says the truth is, I mean, the truth is there is a slight difference. When Makadish Achosoi, everybody knows that you can't be Makadish your sister. Over here, it might be not everybody knows. You can't sell a field in Yovel. So therefore, he may have actually meant it to be a valid sale. And once he finds out that it's an invalid sale, he should get his money back. But the way Rav says, in connection with the sister, but we're saying that's also why Rav Onan wasn't sure. But again, once we have the Braisa, then that clarifies things. Okay. So we're saying, in other words, that it comes out, according to Shmuel, the way Rav Yosef has explained Shmuel, that in the case where he sells the Eved to another Yid in Chutz Laretz, then that second Yid forfeits the money. We don't say that he gets reimbursed by the seller. So, Omale Abayel Rav Yosef, my chos is to consider another keach. In that case, the question is, what makes us say that we should penalize the buyer, that he should forfeit the money? Why don't we instead penalize the seller and make him return the money? He thought he was going to get good money for this Eved, and now he has to return it. So why are we penalizing only the buyer? So Rabbi Yosef answers him, Omale, so he answers him with an expression, Lav achbra ganav el chura ganav. It's not the mouse that's the thief, it's the hole that's the thief. Meaning the mouse needs a hole that it can run away and escape into, where a cat or whatever it is trying to get him. Or elsewhere, Rashi says it means the hole where he stores whatever it is that he took. The point is, in other words, without someone available to buy that Eved, the seller never would have been able to sell him. So therefore, it's more his fault. He made himself available. He said, I want to buy this Eved, even though knowing that this Eved is from Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, we should penalize him. Abai asks, so what? You could still say the other way around. What, the whore wouldn't be doing anything wrong if the mouse hadn't stolen and put something in the hole or run away into the hole. In other words, you're saying you're putting all the blame on the whore, meaning the buyer. But the fact is, there's blame on the seller over here also, because again, if it weren't for him, the buyer wouldn't have had an opportunity to buy an eved like this illegally. So you still have to ask, why are we penalizing Davka the buyer? And the answer is, okay, Mistabra, Hecha, the Ike is sort of Hosam Kansinan. Still, the answer is, Rabbi Yosef answers that, fine, you're right, there is reason maybe to penalize both of them, but what we should assume the one that has the Issur by him is the one that we're going to penalize. The Issur is the Eved who's every day being prevented from doing the mitzvahs that apply only in Eretz Yisrael, because now the master has taken him to Chutz Laaretz. Therefore, more logically, the one by whom that Issur is currently present is the one that we're going to penalize, and therefore he's the one who's going to lose his money. So now that we've talked about dinim involving selling an eved from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laaretz, so now let's talk about the related concept, which is where an eved runs away from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael. How hu avda de orak me Chutz Laaretz Laaretz? There was an eved Knani who ran away from Chutz Laaretz, from a Jewish master in Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael. Also, more abasre. So his master went and followed him to Eretz Yisrael to try to get him to come back to Chutz Laaretz. Also, kamed Rab Ami. So he came in front of Rab Ami to take the eved to Beis Din and force him to come back. Omale. So Rab Ami tells him, you're not taking him back. Nichte v'choshtore adonai. Well, the eved will write you a shtar for his value. Right now he doesn't have money to free himself, but he'll write you a shtar that he owes you that money. You write him a shtar shichur, because now I'm going to explain to you why you're required to free him. The Eloi, and if you don't do that, if you don't write that shtar shichur, I will remove him from you. Matkana means I will take him away from you. Rashi has a slightly different Rashi, and some other Rishonim have a slightly different girsa, mafkana with an ayin in the middle, which means I'll be mafkia, as we've learned that word in the last few days. It means that I will. It means also that I will override your ability to own him, and I will take him away from you. Anyway, I will do that on the basis midir of achi b'rab Yoshia. On the basis of the drosha of Rab Achi Bar Yoshia, that there's a posuk that talks about this exact case, namely the Tanya. We learn in a Braisa. Now the posuk says, you have to get rid of the goyim of the seven nations who live in Eretz Yisrael, and the posuk finishes off Lo Yeshu Ba'aretzcha. They should not dwell in your land. Because they might make you sin against me, because they're going to continue worshiping Avodah Zarah and doing other Averas, and you are going to be influenced to follow them, as in fact happened. We find in Sefer Shoftim that the Jewish people did leave, even though they conquered large parts of Eretz Yisrael and settled it. They still left large enclaves of Goyim here and there in different places in Eretz Yisrael, and they did end up learning a lot from them, and then they have the whole thing in the time of the Shoftim where they're worshiping Avodah Zarah and being conquered by some Goyish nation or other, and then eventually doing tshuva and having a shofet rescue them. Anyway, so the pasuk is warning in advance, don't do that. So now, so you would think that the pasuk is including even a goy who's accepted on himself not to worship Avodah Zarah. This is one of those cases, by the way, where the censor's changing thing in the Gemara has made things a little more confusing. Really, of course, it's supposed to say something like Nochri or goy. So that makes it clearer. We mean a goy who's accepted on himself that he won't worship Avodah Zarah. So you would think maybe the pasuk is talking about him as well. You can't allow him to stay in Eretz Yisrael. There is a Machlokes Rashi and Tosfos elsewhere in Shas. The seven nations themselves, if they accept after the Jewish people have come into Eretz Yisrael that they're not going to worship Avodah Zarah, can we allow them to stay? Or they accept that. And the other shipment says, no, can we allow them to stay? Or do they only have that option before the Jewish people cross the Yarden, but not afterwards? The Machlokas, among other things, how to explain the story of the Givonim, where they tricked the Jewish people into accepting them. Is it that they tricked them because after the Jewish people cross the Yarden, they don't have that option of accepting Shev Mitzvah Bnei Noach, and therefore they had to play a trick? Or is it because they could have accepted Shev Mitzvah Bnei Noach, but they didn't want to be in a subjugated position to the Jewish people? And in the end, of course, they were once the Jewish people found out what they had done. Anyway, the point is, the Braisa is saying, so you would think that even a goy who doesn't worship Avodah Zarah is not allowed to live in Eretz Yisrael. Therefore, Talmud Loma, therefore we have a different pasuk that bears on this. A pasuk in Parashas Ki Tse says, Lois Saskiu Eved Al Adonav, don't hand back an eved to his master. Where this eved is rescued to you from his master. So the Braisek, so in other words, the Braisek is understanding that his master refers to the Avodah Zarah that he was worshiping until now. So now we're saying, Lois Saskir, don't force him to go back to his master, meaning to his old life of Avodah Zarah. Instead, the pasuk continues, Imcha Yesha Bekirbacha. So my takanosai. What does it mean? How do we fix up the situation? What is the Torah saying you should do for him? As the next pasuk continues, Imcha Yesha Bekirbacha. You should allow him to live among you, meaning accept him as a ger toshav. Instead, Lois Saskir, don't hand him back to Saskir literally means like to extradite. So don't extradite him back from Eretz Yisrael, back to his master. In this case, his master being the Avodah Zarah that he served until now, but rather accept him as a ger toshav. Now, that's the beginning of the Braisa. However, the Kashale Lot of Achi Bar Yoshia, however, the Kashale Lot of Yoshia. So now Rabbi Yoshia had difficulty understanding how we learn that from the pasuk. Now Rabbi Yoshia and Rabbi Achi Bar Yoshia, who we're going to go on to quote over here, are actually Tanoim themselves. But they were Tanoim who lived in Bavel, and that's why we actually had Rabbi Achi Bar Yoshia earlier in the Masechta, when we had the story of the two Chachamim who were supposed to pick up a silver keli that belonged to Rabbi Achi Bar Yoshia, and then the people over there were beating them, and you have the whole thing over there about how scary they looked and sounded. Anyway, so they are actually Tanoim, but they were Tanoim who lived in Bavel, which is why the Gemara doesn't quote them in the usual way that it would in a braisa. Anyway, so Rabbi Yoshia has a problem with that. How do we understand it that way? Hi, me'im adonav, me'im oviv mibayulay. In that case, why is it using the expression me'im adonav from his master? Avodah Zarah is not his master. You should say me'im oviv mibayulay. You should say from his father. Meaning, b'pashtos, either because we do actually find in Pesukim where it says, you have a posik omrim la'etz oviata, that goyim say about their wooden idols, you are my father. So in that case, then it should be using that posik. It should be using that expression. Or maybe it means his actual biological father, that his father is trying to prevent him. He's telling him, look, you've grown up as a good member in standing of our religion. Why are you running away from that? And therefore we're saying, don't extradite him. Don't force him to return to his father, who's going to continue pressuring him to remain a goy over Avodah Zarah. But why the expression Adonav? Adonav implies that he's a slave. So therefore, Ela Amar Rabbi Yoshia. So rather, Rabbi Yoshia explains, B'moicher Abdel L'chutz La'aretz HaKosev B'daber. The pasuk is talking about somebody who sells his eved to which actually the Maharam explains that the question is a little bit differently. The question is why Rabbi Yoshia is focusing on the end of the pasuk, Asher Yinotzel Alecha Me'im Adonav, that he saved to you from his master, and he's asking why Me'im Adonav instead of Me'im Oviv. So why does he mention the first half of the pasuk, or on the side of it here? Actually, it says there should be a Girsa Elekov, that he saved to you from his God. But still, the Maharam points out, why doesn't he mention the first half of the pasuk that says, Lois Saskir Evel El Adonav, don't extradite him to his master? Why doesn't Rabbi Yoshia point out, you have the same problem over there? Why are we calling the Avodah Zarah his master? So, okay, you could say that there it means, that there it does mean his Avodah Zarah, that he feels like the Avodah Zarah is his master. But when you say, Yinotzel Alecha Me'im Adonav, that he saved to you, that he escapes to you from Adonav, then And what's this Lashon Hatzalah? How do you use the expression that he's saved? Hatzalah literally means it means on one level to be rescued, of course, which is how we have the organization Hatzalah. The literal meaning of Hatzalah a lot of times means like to extract something from someplace else. You find, for example, that Rashi brings, for example, you have Yaakov's wives, Rachel and Leah, say to him when he's telling him we need to leave Haran and return to Eretz Yisrael, they say that all the wealth, Asher Hitzel or the Kim Me'avinu, that Hashem sort of reserved from our father, that it went to you, it really belongs to us. So therefore, yes, we should get out of here. Before our father demands it back or whatever. Anyway, the point is that the word yinotzel literally means life, like to reserve. So the question really is not so much on the first half of the pasuk. The question is that why are we using the expression that, the question would be why we're saying yinotzel elecha me'im adonav, that how do we talk about hatzolah, how do we talk about reserving him from avodah zarah? So it means, in other words, exactly that. His father, Maharam says, his father is trying to force him to remain an Ovid Avodah Zarah in good standing, and the son is trying to run away. So therefore, the pasuk is saying that, don't force him to go back. But Rabbi Yoshia still says in that case, then it should have said Me'im Oviv rather than Me'im Adonai. So therefore, so Omer Rabbi Yoshia, B'moicher Avdi L'chutz Laretz HaKosim Adaber. So the pasuk is talking about somebody who sells his Eved to Chutz Laretz, which was the subject of our Mishnah. So therefore, the pasuk is saying that now we don't force the Eved to go to Chutz Laretz, we allow him to stay in Eretz Yisrael and to become free. But the Kashalim of Achi by Yoshia, however, of Achi by Yoshia still found Rabbi Yoshia's explanation difficult. Pashtus Rabbi Yoshia is his father, but anyway, he still finds that explanation difficult. Because Hayashev Yinotzel Elecha, then what's the expression that he saved to you, which implying till now he wasn't among you, and now he's coming to you. Hayashev Yinotzel Me'imcha Mibaylei. The expression should be that he saved from you. In other words, he was from among you. He was among Jews, and now he's being sold to a master in Chutz Laretz. And the Torah is saying, according to Rabbi Yoshia, that you're not allowed to you have to allow him to remain a free person and to remain in Eretz Yisrael. So the expression should be Me'imcha. And that would be from Eretz Yisrael. So then it would mean, Asher Yinotzel Me'imcha, that he's being reserved from you, from Eretz Yisrael, he's being separated, rather, Hitzel, then according to that, would be separated, again, by what Rachel and Leah used the expression to Yaakov. So he's about to be separated from you and brought to Chutz Laretz. Don't allow that to happen. So therefore, it should be the phrasing and the pasuk, if that's what it meant. And the Maharam adds that you can't say, or Rashi himself elsewhere explains, it can't mean that the master already freed him and now he's coming to us to Beis Din because his master is threatening to take him back as an Eved. Then the pasuk wouldn't call him an Eved. The very fact that it calls him an Eved implies that that he's still considered an Eved and still. So therefore, Se'ela Omer Abachi Ba Yoshia Be'Eved Cheborach Mechutz La'aretz La'aretz HaKosim Adabur. The pasuk is talking about an Eved, like in this case, who ran away from Chutz Laretz to Eretz Yisrael. So now we understand the pasuk very well. Loi saskir Eved al Adonav, don't extradite a slave to his master, Asher Yinotzel Elecha Me'im Adonav, where he is separated or rescued from his master, meaning his master in Chutz Laretz, whether a goy or a yid, wants to keep him as an Eved, and he runs away and comes to Eretz Yisrael. So the pasuk is saying, Imcha Yeshe Bekir Becha, so you should allow him to live among you. So according to that, Asher Yinotzel Me'imcha, which is the expression in the pasuk, means actually that he would be saved, that he would be running away to you, meaning in Eretz Yisrael. And it means that he's coming to the Beis Din over there to certify that he should be able to stay free. So therefore, we see that Rav Achi bar Yoshia holds that the pasuk is talking about that case and saying you don't extradite the slave and make him return to his master in Chutz Laretz. So now, returning to our case before of this guy whose slave did just that, and he came to Rav Ami to demand a slave back, then Rav Ami told him, on the contrary, you need to free him, and if not, then I'm going to force you to on the basis of Rav Achi bar Yoshia's drasha. That the pasuk is talking about exactly that case, once an Eved, who was in Chutz Laretz, and fine, he was owned by a yid, and you were allowing him to do mitzvahs, of course, but now he runs away to Eretz Yisrael, and now he has the opportunity to do more mitzvahs, then therefore you have to allow him to go free. The Chinuch, in fact, explains the idea behind it is that That because after all, Eretz Yisrael is the special land Hashem wants. Therefore, Hashem wants to give honor to the land that we should realize that we should realize it's a special place, and it provides asylum even for slaves like that, and allows them to become free.
That's probably what Rebbe said. If you go to Israel, you can't come back.
So that may be, it may be related to that. That if a person moves to Israel, if a person goes to Israel, it's not so simple to leave there. That's the, you have other gemaras that bear on that. Not so much involving Avodim, we're going to the end of Ksubas, for example. But yeah, this might factor in. Maybe this factors in there as well. Yeah. Okay. So the gemara says Tanya Idach. Now we learn another brisa that explained, that has other ways of explaining this pasuk. When it says "Lois Saskir Eved Al Adonav," don't extradite a slave to his master. Rebbe Omer Belakech Eved Amanas LeShachar Akosim Adaber. So Rebbe says a whole different thing. It means when a person buys an Eved, having in mind to free him. So then, now Beis Din will not allow the Beis Din will not allow the master to take him back as an Eved. So Heichi Dami. So what is the scenario? How exactly did he word it that it's Amanas LeShachroi? So Amar of Nachmi, the cost of Lehochi, means he wrote him out a document that says Liksha Ekochacha, when I purchase you as an Eved, Hare Atzmacha Koni L'chol Me'achshav, then you are acquired to yourself as of now. So since he said Me'achshav, then as soon as he buys him, then that clause kicks in and says, and therefore he's not able to b'chlal use him as a slave. In fact, Rashi says, from here the Gemara learns, elsewhere we learned in Yevamos, that we talked about the other day, that Rav Meir says, Odom machna davar shalei bo la'olam, that you can do a kinyan on something that doesn't exist yet. We see from this brisa, says the Gemara in Yevamos, that Rebbe agrees with that, because here it doesn't exist yet, he doesn't own the Eved yet, and yet we're saying that this statement takes effect. And as soon as he buys the Eved, then he has to go free. So now, even if the master wants to change his mind, he can't. Okay. So the Gemara tells a story in this connection of Loisaskir Eved Al Adonav. Loisaskir Eved Al Adonav, don't extradite a slave to his master. Yeah. So the Gemara tells Rav Chista Orakle Avdala Bei Kusoi. Rav Chista had a slave who ran away to a place where the Kusim lived. So it was all in Chutz Laaretz. We don't mean that the slave ran away to the Kusim in Eretz Yisrael. The problem is, of course, as we know, the Kusim tend to take Torah Shebichsav very literally. They don't hold of Droshes of Chachamim. So Om Sholachlu Hadrua Niali. So he sent him a message: return this Eved to me. Sholchule. They said, what do you mean? The pasuk says Loisaskir Eved Al Adonav. So therefore, we're not obligated. So therefore, Adrabah, we shouldn't return him to you. It's funny, you know, back in the days, back before the Civil War, when you had slavery in America, and there was the whole debate about whether it should be legal or not, you had the ones who were against it. One of their favorite psukim to quote was this one, that it says, don't return a slave to his master. But as we're seeing in the Gemara over here, as Rav Chista is going to explain to us, it doesn't necessarily mean that, after all, an Eved is a property of his master. In general, we should say, if he runs away, he's still obligated to return him, as Rav Chista is going to point out, the same way as we return any other lost property of somebody. So Sholach Lahu, Rav Chista sends them back a message. What do you mean? You shouldn't return it. The pasuk says, "By Hashavas Aveda, v'chein tasa l'chamora." You should do exactly the same for his donkey. V'chein tasa l'simlosa. You should do the same thing for his clothing. V'chein tasa l'chalavedas achicha, and the same thing for anything else that your brother loses. So that means anything a yid loses, and any asset of his, including an eved, you have to return. So they said, but so how are you understanding that pasuk, which makes it sound like an eved is different than every other kind of lost object?
He sends them, he sells them.
No, because the fact is, I'm sure you not sell Adonav. If he's escaping to you from his master, then you don't return him. So they're taking that literally. Sholach Lahu, so he answers them, Hahu be'evet shabarach mechutz la'oretz la'oretz b'chidir of Achi b'Rav Yoshia. So he answers them, you have to understand that pasuk, the way of Achi b'Rav Yoshia did, that it means where he ran away to Eretz Yisrael, and therefore Asher yinotzel elecha, that he escapes to you, meaning in other words, to you Jews who live in Eretz Yisrael. So it's not referring to you and I are all in chutz la'oretz, therefore that din doesn't apply. So the question is, why should the Sholach Lukid of Achi b'Rav Yoshia? Why Dafka does he send them to that they need to understand the pasuk the way of Achi b'Rav Yoshia does? Why not, for example, the way Rebbe does? Where Rebbe says that it's talking about Bechlal, where you're buying Eved having in mind to free him. And in that case, it has nothing to do with an Eved running away at all. So why not that? So the answer is Mishum de Mashmalahu Kroy, because again, the Kusim take the Psukim very literally. They at least, with Achib Rav Yoshi's explanation, is closer to the Pshat of the Pasuk. So if he told them, like what Rebbe says, we're talking about to begin with, the person bought the Eved, having in mind saying that he was going to free him, they're going to say, no, that doesn't sound anything like what the Pasuk is talking about. But Rav Achib, Rav Yoshi's point, that it refers to an Eved who ran away from Chutz Laaretz to Eretz Yisrael, that they can accept very logically that that is what the Pasuk is referring to, and therefore on that basis, they'll return him the Eved. So, by the way, since we're talking about Chachamim dealing with Kusim when it comes to lost objects, so the Gemara mentions another similar story, not involving an Eved, but Stama lost object. The Gemara says, Abaya Ilkas Lechamra Bekusoi. Abaya one time lost a donkey among the Kusim, again, in Chutz Laaretz.
When did the word Chamra mean wine?
So it's actually, I mean, you have to, they're both spelled the same. Chamra meaning wine, and chamora meaning a donkey. They're written the same. They just have different lakudas. You have to be able to tell from context. Yeah. Here, it's not wine, obviously, because the Gemara is going to go on to say the Gemara is going to go on. No, well, that. But, I mean, irkas means it was lost. But anyway, the point is that the physical characteristics, the simonim that he's going to give, fit a donkey, they don't fit wine. Yeah. So anyway, sholach lahu shadruli. So he sends them a message, send me back the donkey. Sholchulay, so they sent back to him, shlach simana, send a simon. And then if you give us a simon, then we'll return it to you. Sholach lahu, so he sends them back a message, dechivra krese, the belly of the animal is white. Sholchulay, so they sent him back a message, you know what, ilav de nachmeni at. If not for the fact that you are nachmeni, which we've learned before, is a name or a nickname for Abaya. So meaning in other words, we know that you're a great person. We know that you're a great Talmid Chacham. Lo yhavim ashadan yalei nialoch. If it weren't for that, we wouldn't send back this animal to you on that basis. Don't all donkeys have white bellies? So it's not really a simon at all. So therefore, so what are you even thinking of giving us such an indistinct simon? Now, what was Abaya thinking and what were they thinking? So the Chassam Sofer gives an explanation. We know that you can return, we know that a Talmid Chacham is entitled to claim his lost object even without an actual simon, just with tvias ayin. I may not be able to give a specific simon on it, but I recognize it on site. And as long as he's a Talmid Chacham, who the Gemara says in Eilam Atzias, that he only alters his words, he doesn't quite say the complete truth by three things, the Masechta, the Purio, the Shpiza, and also Tosfos adds over there by making shalom between people, then you know he's honest, and then you can return him something to be assigned. Anyway, so obviously, right, this week's parasha. Oh, right, that Aaron was Oyev Shalom, Rode of Shalom, yeah, that's true, yeah. Anyway, the point is, therefore, so the Chassam Sofer explains what was going on over here. When they tell him, so Abaya is demanding demanding the donkey back, he wants to get it back with Tvias Ayin. He doesn't want to have to provide a simon. The Kusim send back, they'll provide a simon. So Abaya is saying, you know what, they don't trust me with Tvias Ayin. However, the Chassam Sofer points out, now what happens is, if a Talmid Chacham has a simon on the object, then we have a right to say, you know what, maybe we shouldn't rely on us Tvias Ayin. Tvias Ayin means he can say, I recognize it on site. I don't have any particular simon. But if he has a simon that's not quite so distinctive, it's not a simon muvhak like we learned back on Daf Chof Zayin, he may mistakenly rely on that not so deterministic simon and think that because of that it's his, even though there may be other things out there that have that simon. So therefore he deliberately sends them not a simon that might be sort of distinctive, but a simon that's not distinctive at all, like a simon garua, we called it over there, a very weak simon. In other words, as if to say that, look, I don't think I need simonim. I need only to be a sign. To the extent that I'm going to give you a simon, it's going to be one that's so weak you can't possibly think that I'm relying on that simon. And they reply back to him and say, okay, now we realize you want it. You want to claim it on the basis of being a Talmid Chacham and to be a Sayin. And that's why if you weren't Nachmeni and you gave us such a weak simon, we would ignore it. Now that you're Nachmeni, since you're Abaya and you gave us such a simon garua, we put two and two together. We realize the reason you're giving such a weak simon is to to alert us, you're not at all relying on the simon, you're relying on Tobias Ayin, fine, we're able to return it to you on that basis. Because you're being a Talmud Chacham, we can return it, we'll return it to you based on Tobias Ayin. So that's how the Chassam Sofer explains that was the whole back and forth.
So he's saying that
he don't get out here, he can't say. So that means he went over to the Kusim and then told them, I don't know, yeah. Okay.
And the single one says that the Talmud Chacham could even get something as new.
Yeah, that's the point over there. You have something that doesn't have a simon yet, right? That's the Chassam Sofer is explaining, that if he has a simon in it, then that sort of weakens the claim with Tobias Ayin, because then there's a possibility that he's mistakenly relying on the simon. Even now, we learned before on Daf Chof Zayin, we talk about you have three different grades of simonim. You have simon muvhak, something which is absolutely distinctive. For example, we said over there that the get has a hole by a certain letter. No other get, the Pashtos, has a hole in exactly that place. Then you have something which is a less distinctive simon. Say, for example, that the get has a hole at all. Or then you have a completely indistinct simon. For example, we said there that the get is long or short, where there are thousands of long gittin and thousands of short gittin. So here, saying that the donkey has a white belly, it is an example of that third kind of simon, whereas if Abaya had given something like the second kind of simon, then the Kusim might have said, oh, you're relying on that simon, but it's not so distinctive. There are some other donkeys that have that simon as well, and therefore your Tobias Ayin is not going to work. That's why Dafka, he sent them the weakest kind, the worst kind of simon, a simon garua, and then they realize that that he's not relying on the simon at all. He's relying strictly on Tobias Ayin. Okay. Mishnah says, continuing on this topic of Tikkun HaOlam, Ein Poydin Es HaShvuyin Yoyser HaKadei Demeyen Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. We do not ransom captives, people who were captured by Goyim, for more than they're worth because of Tikkun HaOlam. What they're worth, actually, the Me'iri brings two possibilities. He says most of the Rishonim understand it means the value. Suppose the guy was to be sold as an Eved, how much would he fetch at an auction for Avodim? And he says some say that it means depending on his wealth. So a richer person, you might be able to pay more for him. So Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam, because of Tikkun HaOlam, and we'll see in the Gemara exactly what the Tikkun HaOlam is with that. Also, Ve'en Mavrichin Es HaShvuyim Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. Also, we do not help captive escape from the Goyim Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam for the same reason Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam, and we'll see in the Gemara what that is. Reb Shimon Gamliel, Mipnei Tikkun HaShvuyim. Reb Shimon Gamliel says it's meant as a takona for the captives themselves, and again, we'll see in the Gemara what Reb Shimon Gamliel means by that. So the Gemara says, Yibayilahu. Hi, Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam. When we're saying you don't ransom, you don't redeem captives, you don't do pidyon shvuyim for more than they're worth, is it, when we say Mipnei Tikkun HaOlam, Mishum Duchka Ditziburu, is it because of the burden it would place on the tzibur, that's going to be a huge amount of money that they have to raise? Or is it maybe we don't want to give the goyim an incentive to kidnap Jews more often? So if they get an inflated price for him, then they're going to have more of an incentive to do this in the future. Which, by the way, we have famously the story of Maharam Rutenberg, where he was arrested by the government, by the German king of that time, and they raised an enormous amount of money to free him. And the Maharam said, you shouldn't do that because of this over here, because we don't want to give them an incentive. It worked, by the way, because once this emperor realized he's not getting, eventually, many, many years later, his successors got, because eventually after Maharam Rutenberg passed away in jail, 14 years passed, and then a rich yid, Maharam Rutenberg, came to this rich yid in a dream and told him he should go and ransom him. But that was already years later, and it wasn't the original king, so therefore, like, they're not going to have an incentive. And it worked, Taka, because after Maharam Rutenberg, they never tried that again. They never tried that idea of kidnapping Chachamim and holding them for ransom, because they saw it didn't work that time. So that's exactly what we're saying over here in the Gemara.
He stayed there
for 7 years and passed away in jail there. Yeah, we have many famous the Pashtos from old age. I mean, he was in his 70s or mid to late 70s when he passed away. Yeah,
how many years ago
was it? It was in the late 1200s, so you're talking 730 years ago or so. Tosfos, by the way, points out, now there do seem to be exceptions to that. We learned in Ksubas that when a man's wife is taken prisoner, he's responsible to pay even 10 times her value. But Tosfos says, Ishtik Gufay, that's different. When it comes to a person himself, Kol Ashele Ish, Yitin Bad Nafshe, a person is entitled to offer however much money he wants to save himself. What we're talking about as far as other people. Also, then Tosfos points out, now we're going to discuss this in a couple of weeks, Bas Hashem, when we have the Sugya of the Churban, we're going to have the story over there of Rabbi Yeshua goes to Rome and he finds over there in the jail. They tell him there's a Jewish boy in jail, and Rabbi Yeshua eventually realizes, based on the story over there, that this boy has the capability to become a tremendous Talmid Chacham, and he says, I'm going to pay no matter what it takes to ransom him from jail, and he does, and this boy grew up to be the famous Tana Rabbi Shmuel. So what do you mean that Rabbi Yeshua is saying, I'll pay whatever it takes for him, if we're saying over here that you shouldn't? So Tosfos gives a couple of reasons. Over here, Tosfos says that, first of all, he was muflag b'chachma. He was an unusual Talmid Chacham, even at that age. So therefore, that's an exception. Also, Tosfos says, look, it was the time of the Churban. All Jews are anyway in danger of being kidnapped and killed by the Romans. So therefore, you can't say, don't give them an incentive to do it more. They don't need any more incentive. Tosfos over there gives a different explanation, which is also that his life was in danger. And so Tosfos says that would be another valid reason to overpay for him. That one, various other Rishonim argue with, and they say, look, every time a person is captured by Goyim, his life is in danger. But the other two reasons, those are reasons that the other Rishonim subscribe to as well.
One, the fact he was then a child, they would let him go for cheaper than...
Maybe, but the fact is, Rabbi Yeshua still said, kol mom and shabbat olam, no matter how much they charge him. Okay, anyway, so that's the question. So is the fundamental mepnei tikkun olam in order not to burden the tzibur too much, or is it not to give the goyim an incentive to keep kidnapping Jews? So the Gemara says, Toshma, well, let's try to bring a proof. The Levi bar Darga, Parka Librati, Kleiser Alpha Dinre Zahad. Levi bar Darga, is the guy's name, he ransomed his daughter for 13,000 gold dinar, which is far more than she would have been worth as a maidservant. So therefore you see that it's not a matter of, it's his daughter, but still a daughter is not the same. Tosfos says, Ishtik Gufay, his daughter is not quite Gufay. But still, so therefore that shows on the face of it that the problem must be because of Duchka de Tzibura. So then if there's not an issue of Duchka de Tzibura, Levi bar Darga is rich and he has the money himself, then it would be allowed. But Omer Abayo man le malandim b'tzen chachamim avad. But Abayo says, who says that this Levi bar Darga did it with the consent of the chachamim? Dumash le b'tzen chachamim avad. Maybe the chachamim would not have approved of it, and he didn't listen to the chachamim and went and did it anyway. So no proof from that story.
He didn't ask any questions,
right? Since we're talking about people, so then the Mishnah continues. We don't help captives escape because of Tikkun Olam. And we said, Rav Shimon Gamliel says not Tikkun Olam, but it's rather in order to improve things for the captives themselves. So the Gemara says, what is the practical difference between them? In other words, Mipnei Tikkun Olam implies that it benefits society. Mipnei Tikkun HaShvuyim implies that somehow it benefits the captives themselves to not be enabled to escape jail. In other words, the idea is that if it can mean, in other words, that that if you're that they may, for example, it may mean that the goyim are going to go and then start harassing and beating up the other captives. Why didn't you come and tell us that this guy is planning to escape? Let's say. So Rav Shimon Gamliel seems to be saying that's the issue. So the Gemara says, "My benayu ikabenayu deleka elachat." Suppose right now there's only one person in captivity by those goyim. The Tanakhama is concerned that in the future they may say, you know what, Jews are helping our other Jews are helping our Jewish captives escape. We better shackle them. We better put them in strong chains and in solitary confinement and so on and so forth, so that they're not able to get to them. So then it's going to make things worse for Shvuyim in the future, and therefore the Tanakhama is saying don't allow them, don't help them escape. Help them get ransom, but not to escape. Right? Whereas Rav Shimon Gamliel would be saying that it's mepnei takonas shvuyim, because the goyim may take it out on the rest of the captives over there. Well, if there's no rest of the captives, if there's only the one right now, then Rav Shimon Gamliel would say that's not a concern. So therefore, according to him, if there's only one captive, then yes, you can help him escape. Whereas according to the Tanakhama, not. Because in the future, so that's the thing. Rav Shimon Gamliel is not so concerned about the future. He's concerned about right now. So since we're talking about people escaping from captivity, so now the Gemara tells a story in this connection. As background for the story, Binsei de Rab Nachman Bochshen de Rab Yadayu. Rab Nachman's daughters would stir pots of hot food with their bare hands, without their hands getting burned. So it seemed like the great Sidkonius. But Kashle de Rab Ilish found it difficult to understand how such a thing could be. After all, Ksiv, you have a posik in Kehelas, Odom Echad Me'elef Matzasi, Shlomo HaMelech says, I found one out of 1,000 people who is a tzaddik. Rashi actually in the posik explains a little differently that it means you have, let's say, 1,000 kids go into cheder, and one of them comes out as Yotze Lahira, that he's able to actually pass in halacha for the public. Most of the others, I mean, they don't really drop out, but let's say you have some of them are only capable of getting as far as Mikra, and some of them only, and some of them, and fewer number only as far as Gemara, and so forth. And then you have one who comes out the consummate Talmud Chacham. But here, Rashi understands, based on the context of the Gemara, that means that one out of 1,000 becomes a great tzaddik. But Shlomo continues, "V'isha b'chol eila loy matzasi." I have not found among them any woman, because it's a not to say that there aren't sidkonius, but it's much rarer to find. And the point is, so there are different mafoshim that point out over here. For example, we find various tzaddikim in Jewish history who went through fire and came out unscathed. Avraham Avinu, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah. We never find such a thing by a woman. So where is there a precedent that Reb Nachman's daughters should be on a level like that to be saved from fire? Now, there is also the point, the Rashash points out, what about Ma'ukva's wife? You have the story in Ksubas over there where they're giving tzedakah and they run away into an oven and her feet are not burnt. But in fact, an answer is, look, you know, it's different in that case. First of all, there was no alternative. They had to run away into the oven. Here they have an alternative. Why are they stirring the pots with their bare hands? They can't afford a ladle. And also there it was in private, there it was only in the presence of her and Ma'ukva. Here we're talking about in public, in front of other people, and for example, Rav Ilish is seeing it. So it's unusual, Rav Ilish is saying that there should be women on such a level of tzidkus to the extent to be saved from fire like that, especially publicly. So he didn't know. So he asks, what do you mean? Why is Shlomo saying that there's no such women? Bo'ika bin said that Rav Nachman. What about Rav Nachman's daughters? They seem to be on that level. Well, the matter caused them this, that they were taken captive. Meaning Marashah says the very fact that Reb Ilish was wondering about it and that they were doing this caused that they should be captured in order that eventually the truth should come out, as the Gemara is going to go on to say what happened. What's going on, but in other words, because they were doing this, and because Reb Ilish was wondering about it, Hashem arranged circumstances that they all got captured in by Goyim in order that the truth would eventually come to light. So the Ishtaboy, Yunami Badayo, Reb Ilish was also captured by the same Goyim together with them. One day, while he was in captivity, Reb Ilish is sitting together with a person. This other person knew the language of the birds. So he knew when birds are twittering what they're actually saying. So a raven came and started making noise and started cawing near them. So Reb Ilish asks the guy, what is this raven saying? You understand the language of the birds. What's it saying? So the guy answers, it's saying, Ilish brach, Ilish brach, Ilish run away, Ilish run away. So he's telling you, it's telling you it's time to run away. And in fact, Marashah says it's repeating it, like to certify it's definitely so. Go, run away. This is your opportunity. Gilyan Ashas, by the way, brings an interesting point. Rabbi Akiva Eger brings that the Oruch actually says that we see from this story that Reb Ilish knew the language of the birds. But Rabbi Akiva Eger says, what do you mean? We see clearly from the story that Reb Ilish did not know the language of the birds, and he has to ask the guy. So he leaves the question open. There's Achronim talk about possible answers, one of them being one possible answer is the very fact that Reb Ilish realized the bird is saying something. Why didn't he just assume the bird is making noises, like birds make noises? Shows he understood there's something, he just maybe didn't understand that 100%. Or maybe he wanted to confirm. Yeah, maybe he wanted to confirm his understanding. Yeah. Anyway, but Reb Ilish says, no, Urva Shikrahu, the raven is a liar. I don't necessarily rely on it. I'm not relying on it to risk my life and go run away. Marashah points out, we have all the way back by Noach and the Teva, where he sent a raven as his messenger and it didn't fulfill its mission, and by Yetze Yotze Vashoven, it's just circling around the Teva rather than coming back and reporting to Noach what's going on. So we see, in other words, that a raven is not reliable for this purpose. Adahochi, meanwhile, as they were talking, or as Reb Ilish was thinking about this, also Yonah Pakalia, a dove came and also started cooing and making noises. Omale Maikomra, and again, Reb Ilish asks the guy, what is it saying? Omale, and again he says, it's saying Ilish Brach, Ilish Brach. Reb Ilish thinks to himself, Omer, Knesset Yisroel Yonah Masila, the Jewish people are compared to a dove, because a dove is always faithful to its master and to its mate. I mean, a dove is a dove's mate, and doves are one of the few kind of birds that mate for life. And a dove, the Gemara mentions, and in the story of Elisha Baal Kanafayim in Shabbos, that a dove protects itself with its wings, unlike most of the birds that protect themselves with their beaks. And therefore, that represents that all wings are Torah and mitzvahs, and we're protected with those, etc. So there are various ways in which we Jewish people are compared to a dove.
You don't want to carry the dove.
Then that's what you think of an eagle. An eagle carries its young on its back. That's something else. Yeah. But throughout Shir HaShirim, there's a number of places it actually brings one of them, Yonosi Tamosi, and there's other such psukim that compare the Jewish people to a faithful dove. Anyways, and Marsha adds, also by Noach, again, we see the dove was faithful to its mission. It actually went and brought back Noach and olive leaf over there. So therefore, yeah. So,
I didn't know it was two different birds, okay.
Yeah, so, there were two. Yeah, first there was a raven, then there was the dove, yeah. So, yeah. So now he says, Shmamina Misrachish Linisa. So Ilish thinks to himself, the dove, I can trust. That means Hashem is telling me there's gonna be a nest for me. Somehow I will be able to escape and get away safely. Well, Omar, he thinks to himself, Ezel Echse bin Siddur of Nachman. Let me go find out what's going on with Rav Nachman's daughters. E Kaiman Behemun Nusayu, if they're still faithful to Yiddishkeit, then Adrinu, then I'll bring them along with me. If the nest is gonna happen to me, it should help them as well. Which Marshall points out, he knew obviously the Goyim were keeping them as concubines and having relations with them, but as far as he knew, it's not willingly. So therefore, let me find out if they're doing it unwillingly. If it's oynes, then by all means, we should save them as well. They're Jewish women. So now he figures, how am I going to find out? He thinks to himself, Noshi komili de islu sadran la dodi bebesakise. Whenever women have private matters to talk about, they talk about it in the bathroom. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that Rabbi Yossi, who was a couple of hundred years before this, had made a takana that women should go to the bathroom together. Because in those days, the bathrooms were outside the city. So there could be, they're not only dangerous, but there could be a problem of yichud. There could be a problem that one man would walk, that they're in the bathroom, they're alone by themselves, and a man walks in, and then you have a problem of yichud. So like this, when you have two women together, that and they're going to be talking with one another, a man will hear women's voices, and he'll know not to go in. So therefore, so he figures they're going to be talking to each other over there. So let me go hide out near there, and I'll hear what they're, and I'll eavesdrop on that.
Yeah, there's no signs of women's bathroom.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Shamino de Kamran, he overheard them saying, Adi Guvrin, these guys, Goyim, are now our husbands, or Nahadoi Guvrin, and the men from Nahada, the Jews, our Jewish husbands, were also our husbands. In other words, we're in a good situation over here, the same as we were in the Haudah. So we don't need our original husbands anymore. In fact, let's tell the Goyim who captured us that they should take us far away from here, because otherwise people may hear that we're here, that the Goyim who captured us are here, and they're going to hear and ransom us, and we don't want to be ransomed. At this point, we're happy with our life with the Goyim. So he realized, obviously, they're not. So obviously, a nest is not going to happen to them. Come Orak, sort of Elish got up and ran away. Also, Ihu Vahu Gabra. He and that other guy were running away together. L'diday Isra Chishle Nisa. So to him, to Rav Elish, a nest happened. Over the Mabra, he was safely able to cross the river. Vahu Gabra, where was that other guy, Ashkechua, the Goyim caught up with him, the Kaplua, and they killed him. Rabbi Yaakov Emden says in his notes on the Gemara that this guy may have been a goy, so we shouldn't shed too many tears over the fact that a nest didn't happen to him. If it was a yid, maybe, you know, the fact that he helped out Rav Ilish maybe would have helped for his schus, but yeah.
He used him to help the deacon run, and then he hung on to run with him.
Yeah, but in other words, the guy, a nest didn't happen to him. That's, yeah. Anyway, Ki Hodron Va'osan. Eventually, these women came back. Rashi explained, eventually the Jews of Nahada found out that yes, they were, or actually Rashi doesn't say, but whatever, the point would seem to be, I think Maharsha says that they ended up ransoming them against their will, even though these women were saying, we don't want to be ransomed. In the end, the Jews found out that yes, these Goyish captors were in the area, and they went and paid the money and got these women back.
To take the money.
I guess so, yeah. But they continued to do what they were doing before with the pots. Omar, sort of Elish, realizes Habakkabach and Kidra B'chshofim. I understand they were using kishuf. It wasn't because they were tzidkonius. I was wondering, how did it come that you have such a rare level of tzidkus by women? So now I understand it was all kishuf. which means the Chassam Sofer says, in other words, he was saying, now you could think, maybe they did tshuva. Maybe after they were ransomed, they did tshuva. He says, fine, obviously they could have done tshuva, but then why would they go back to doing the same thing as they did before with stirring the pots? It must be that all along they were doing it with kishuv, and now also they haven't really done tshuva, and they're continuing to be like that. It's brought in Sifrei Kabbalah that these daughters of Reb Nachman are actually a Gilgal of the daughters of Lot. So they, the first time around, they ended up being with their father and fathering the nations of Ammon and Moab, and now also we're saying that they messed up and they're doing kishuv over there.
They came back as a Gilgal,
and then they had another chance, and they messed up this time too. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Mishnah says, "Ve'em loit chin sporim tefillin mezuzas mina ob gechavim yoser akdei demayim." We don't buy Sifrei Torah or other sforim of Tanakh or tefillin or mezuzas from goyim for more than they're worth. So if goyim have stolen them or whatever, we buy them back from them, but we don't pay too much. Again, netikun olam, because of tikun olam, where either of the considerations that we said before could apply. We don't want to be matriach on the tzibur to have to pay so much money, and we don't want to give them an incentive to steal them again and again. So the Gemara says, omelette budya lot of ashi. So the implication of the Mishnah is you don't pay too much for them, more than they're worth. But the implication is you do pay their fair market value. Well, on the face of it, if we're buying a Sefer Torah from a goy, the pashtus, it would mean that we're due because we want to use it as a Sefer Torah and shul. Well, the question is, does that mean that we can actually use such a Sefer Torah for reading in public rather than have to be concerned, as the Gemara is going to now discuss in a couple of lines, maybe we should have to be concerned that the Goy himself wrote it in the name of Avodah Zarah, and therefore Adrabah should be burnt, and we certainly can't be Yotze in public with it. The answer is no, Duma Ligno is not necessarily, because maybe the Mishnah means you have to buy it from them in order to put it in Gniza, because in case it might be a genuine Sefer Torah, but maybe you're Taka, maybe the Mishnah does not mean that you should actually be able to read in it, because there is always the possibility that maybe the Goy himself wrote it.
So Duma could be talented a little bit.
Maybe, but now we're going to discuss that point a little bit. Omer Reb Nachman, so Reb Nachman says, Naktinan, we have the Kabbalah from our Rebbeim, Sefer Torah shekosvim min yisorif. If a Sefer Torah was written by a min, then we burn it. A min is a person who believes, and in many places in Shas, it means a person who believes that there's two gods, for example, that Amnon gives more definitions, that it means that he believes that Hashem has a body, for example, he believes various other wrong things about Hashem, so he's classed as a min. It includes the early Christians, many of whom started out as Jews, and includes various other people like that. So if he writes it, it should be burnt. Rashi says, because the Gemara elsewhere explains that a min is somebody who's oduk l'avodah zarah. He's very fanatically devoted to avodah zarah. And then the Gemara elsewhere says the idea that stam machsheves min l'avodah zarah. Whenever he thinks about something involving God or divinity or whatever, he by default, we assume he's thinking about his getchke. So the same way over here, if he writes a Sefer Torah, then every time he writes the name of Hashem, he's having in mind his avodah zarah. Therefore, you should burn it. And then Amram says it slightly differently, that he doesn't believe in Kedushas Hashem, that he thinks that it's just the equivalent of any other word. So he's just writing it as though it was a mundane word. And therefore, the reason why the mitzvah is to burn it, that Amram says is we don't want to leave any trace of what the minim do in the world. Anyway. So Kosver Ovid Kechavim, on the other hand, Reb Nachman says, if a goy writes a Sefer Torah, Yigonez, it's that we don't have to burn it, but we should put it in Shemus because we can't use it because it wasn't written Lashma. So the Nimtza B'yad Ovid Kechavim, what happens if it was found in the hand of a goy, like in the case of our Mishnah, so we don't know who wrote it. So then, Amri lo Yigonez, v'Amri lo Korinvay. Some say you have to put it in Shemus. Others say you could read with it because it's only a Svek Sveka. Maybe a Yid wrote it, and even if a Goy wrote it, maybe he didn't write it L'Shema V'Rezara. That's how Rashi learns. In other words, it comes out from Rashi that it's not necessarily that it has to be written L'Shema. As long as he didn't write it L'Shema V'Rezara, then it would be fine. Tosfos disagrees with that and says the fact is it has to be written L'Shema. But rather, the reason is it's much more likely that a Yid write it. It's not wrote it. It's not normal that a Goy should write a Sefer Torah. He doesn't, like you said before, doesn't necessarily have the talent or anything like that. So it's much more likely that a Yid wrote it and it fell into the hands of the Goy. Yeah. So in practice, we often see that they do. You have, for example, Sefer Torah, let's say, that were rescued from the Holocaust or whatever, and are often used to lame, because you would assume nowadays a Goy doesn't sit down and write a Sefer Torah. Okay. So the Gemara continues. Sefer Torah shekosvei over to Kechavim. Now, if a Sefer Torah was written by a goy, you have three different brises that say what you do with it. So here we're talking about, we know that a goy wrote it. So let's say we know a goy had the talent and went and did it. So Tony Chodi Yisorif, one brisa says you should burn it. V'tanya Iduch Yigonez, a second brisa says you should put it in Sheamus. V'tanya Iduch Koden, by a third brisa says you can read from it. So what do we? How do we reconcile the three brises? So the answer is Loikasha. Hod Tanya Yisorif Rabbi Lozeri, Rabbi Yezeri, the one that says you should burn it follows the opinion of Rabbi Yezer, who says Stam Machshavas Over Kachavim Labad Kachavim. Not just a min, he says that any goy we assume by default that he has in mind is Avodah Zarah. The original place Rabbi Yezer says this in the case of a shechita of a goy. If a goy shechts an animal, not only are you not allowed to eat it, but he says it's also Bahana, because we assume that he shechted it as a korban for Avodah Zarah. So by the same token, Rabbi Yezer would say that if he writes a Sefer Torah, he has in mind that should be in honor of his getchka. Therefore, you burn. Like wine. Well, wine is something else, but yeah.
Must be so much about, you know, the everything do that they would pour it without.
Yeah, there is that. Okay, right. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But here he says that, yes, Stam Machshev, so even he's doing something mundane, like shechting an animal, or in this case, writing a Sefer Torah, he's having in mind Avodah Zarah, and therefore, according to Rabbi Yezer, you would burn it. V'hod Tanya Yigonez, high Tanu. The one who says you would put it in Sheamus is the Tana of the following Braisa, the Toni Rav Amnuna Brei de Rava Miparshunia, Sefer Torah, Tefillin and Mezuzas, Shekosvan Min, any of these things that were written by a Min, or Marshal takes that out, because we said before that a Min, you burn it, Umosser, or if it was written by a Mosser, by a Yid who masters Jewish property or Jews themselves to Goyim, or if it was written by Ovid Kechavim, if it was written by Goy, the Eved, or by an Eved Knani, Isha, or by a woman. Now, a woman and the rest of an Eved and the rest of them are not, they're not chayiv in the mitzvah of tefillin. So the cotton or child, the kursi, the Yisrael mumer, or Yid who's shmadzich, all of those psulin, so they're all posel, so you don't have to burn them, but you do have to put them in Sheamus because you can't use them.
One second,
because the posel is kshautam la'oysa yedecha, and then it continues, uchsavtam amazuz besecha, so we learn from that, kol shi yeshne b'kshira, yeshne b'ksiva. Anybody to whom the concept of kshira, putting on tefillin, applies, is able to write tefillin and write these other things. Anybody who's not subject to the mitzvah of kshira is not able to write. So that explains also. So yes, so the goy, the eved, and so forth. Yes, it also explains the woman, because the fact is obviously she's not in the same category as them. But nevertheless, the fact is she's not chayiv in the mitzvah of kshira of tefillin. In fact, Tosfos says on this basis, then a woman should also not be binding a lulav or tying tzitzis because she doesn't have those mitzvahs. However, Tosfos disagrees. Tosfos goes on to disagree with that and say that no, it would be kosher. In practice, in Shulchan Aruch, it says that it's better that it's been in deference to Rabbi Natan's opinion. It's better to have a ben das do it. You do have, for example, that a cotton can tie tzitzis onto his own get by a beggar, because look, he's not really chayiv in the mitzvah yet anyway. But for a cotton or an isha to tie tzitzis for a gadol, it is best not to do.
The
women have good handwriting. Let's do it. Anyway, the point is, so the second braisa that said yigonez would follow that opinion. So again, you don't have to burn it, but you do have to put it in Sheamus because it would be possible because they wrote it. Now, the third braisa of a Hodatanya Koding boy, the one who says you could read with that Sefer Torah that you found in the hand of a goy, or not that you found, so we said Sefer Torah should cost if a goy wrote it. So we said you have an opinion that you could actually read with it in public. So that third braisa, high Tana, who that would follow the Tana of the following braisa, the Tanya. You're allowed to buy svarim, meaning sifrei Torah, from goyim anywhere, meaning even in places where there aren't Jews, because it's much more likely that the goy, Chassam Sofer explains, it's much more likely that either the goy bought it or stole it or whatever from a yid, or that Taka, he wrote it intending to sell it to Jews, because again, he knows that there's a market for it. So that braisa said you could, or rovadshi uksuvim kil chassam, as long as it's written according to the halachas of a sefer Torah, in fact, there was a story where a particular guy in the city of Tzidon was writing Sifrei Torah, the Hittit of Mishim Gamliel, Likach Mimenu, and Mishim Gamliel allowed Jews to buy those Sifrei Torah from him and use them for Kriya B'tzibur. So we see that there is an opinion that says that goyim are allowed to write Sifrei Torah. So the question is, Ibud Lashman Boy, Ksiva Lashman Lai Boy. So what are you telling me? Rav Shimon Gamliel requires that the leather, that the parchment for the Sefer Torah should be tanned, should be processed Lashma, but he doesn't know the writing has to be Lashma. And we say a Goy doesn't have the ability to do Lashma, because even if a Yid tells him write Lashma, he still has his own agenda in mind. So does Rav Shimon Gamliel really hold that? That therefore he says you're allowed to buy Sefer Torah from a Goy? Detanya. We learn in a brisa. We learn in a brisa. Sipon zahav. If you plated the tefillin with gold, and they're not, of course, the batim are supposed to be made out of leather without anything on top of them. Or shetolalein or behemetmeya. Or if he covered the tefillin with leather made from the skin of a non kosher animal. Psulis, then the apostle. But if he uses the skin of a kosher animal, then the tefillin are kosher. And that would be, the Tanakhama says, even if he didn't process the leather lishman, but Rav Shimon Gamliel filo or behemah tahor psulis. No, even if it was from the skin of a kosher animal, it would be possible. Ad sheyabden lishman, unless he tans them lishman. So he holds that even the tanning has to be done lishman. How much more so he's going to hold that the writing has to be done lishman? How can he allow sefer Torah that are written by a goy? The answer is Amar Rav Bar Shmuel beger shechozer l'surai. What we're talking about over here, a ger who went back to his old ways worshiping Avodah Zarah. So he knows the concept of the Shema. He was at one point a Yid, and therefore he was at one point a Yid and keeping mitzvahs, and therefore he knows the concept of the Shema. The question is, Lasurai Koshkin to Avalei Min. In that case, Adarabi, he becomes a Min, and then we said before, Sefer Torah written by a Min has to be burnt. But Pashtus, we would assume if he went back to Avodah Zarah, it means he's really fanatical and really, really devoted to it. That would make him a Min. The answer is Amar Avashi shechozer l'surei mishum yira. What we mean is he went back to acting as a goy out of fear. So let's say it was a time when it was illegal to become a ger, and he was afraid. Now, if the goyim find out he became a ger, then they're going to arrest him or torture him or whatever, like Avram ben Avram and other famous gerim in Jewish history. So therefore, because of that, this guy didn't have the strength to withstand that, and therefore he went and reverted to acting like a goy. But we're not talking about that he actually believes in Avodah Zarah, and therefore he doesn't actually believe in Avodah Zarah, so therefore Rav Shimon Gamliel can still allow the Sefer Torah that he wrote. There are actually a few different explanations among the Mephoshim what it means. It means maybe that Rav Shimon Gamliel is talking about an actual goy. He just means because we see, in other words, once we see that we don't hold, of course, Yeshnev Kshira, Yeshnev Ksiva, because this guy is not putting on tefillin anymore, and nevertheless, we still allow him to write. So we see, therefore, the same thing could apply to a complete goy. That's how Marshall learns. Or it can mean that Rav Shimon Gamliel is talking about that case, a ger shechozer l'surai, whereas the Tanakhama was talking about an actual goy who never became a ger in the first place. That's how the Pnei Yeshua learns. And then, fine, it means that to begin with, when the Braise said a goy wrote a Sefer Torah, then you can buy it from him, and Rav Shimon Gamliel allows it, would be talking specifically this case of a ger shechozer l'surai machnas yira. So you have three different ways of understanding the situation. By the way, when we said before that a moiser is included in this category, you can't write tefillin. The question is why? On the face of it, a moiser is chayiv in mitzvahs, just like any other Jew, and maybe even he does put on tefillin. So the Ritva explains that it's a gzeira of the chachamim. And then there were different other explanations that maybe it means that because in fact Rashi over here implies that it's minat Torah that he's possible, because once he's throwing off something so important of Torah, then you can say, in other words, that he himself is obviously the fact that what is he doing? He's massing Jews to goyim where they may end up being arrested and prevented from doing mitzvahs. So if we see that he is so careless about mitzvahs that he doesn't care that a fellow yid is going to end up not being able to keep mitzvahs, then we can't trust his mitzvah observancy. We put him in chayram maybe, yeah, but that's something else, yeah. Okay, anyway. So continues the Gemara. So that would be the case, in other words, that there might be a case where we allow it. Okay, now, getting back to what we said in the Mishnah, that you don't buy Sifrei Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzahs from Goyim for too much money. So, however, Tonan Abanim, we learn in a Braisa, Malin B'dmehen Ad Kedei Tarpi. We do raise the price by a little bit, by a tout pick. In other words, as we said, we don't want to give Goyim incentive to steal Sfarim, but to overpay a little bit, that it's not so obvious, so therefore it's not going to give him such an incentive to do it in the future. So in other words, it doesn't have to be that you have to stick to the exact dollar value. You're allowed to go a little bit above it. What is my tout? Amar Rav Sheshi is istira. It means an istira, which is like this. An istira is a coin that's worth a half a dinar, but it's actually a stira, means a sela medina. It means like this. We find throughout Shas, they had two different systems of currency. There was sela tsuri, which was coins that were minted in the city of Tsur, which were more or less pure silver. And then you had what was called kesef medina, which is, that was minted in Eretz Yisrael, which was only 1/8 silver, and the rest was copper. So even though they have the same face value, they're both called a sela, but one is worth only 1/8 of the other. An istira is half of that. So it comes out to, an istira is equal to a sela medina, which is 1/8 of a sela tsuri. So that's a small amount of money. So therefore, if you're overpaying by that, then it's not a problem. With that said, there are mephoshim, we'll have a different explanation. The Tosfos Yishanim brings over here on a side that the Gemara is not saying something directly related to the din of our Mishnah. Rather, the Gemara is telling us a side point. When a person is writing, a sofer is writing Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzahs, he shouldn't be trying to make a profit on it too much, but he is allowed to make a little bit of a profit, the amount of a tarpeh. So according to that, it has nothing to do with buying them from Goyim. It has to do, Tosfos Yishanim says, the amount that a person is allowed to earn a profit on selling Sefer Torah. So the Gemara tells a story. Now, on the other hand, you have to be careful not to undervalue it to the goy, as we're going to see from the following story. So the Gemara says, "Hahi Tayosa." There was an Arab lady. She brought a small bag with several pairs of tefillin with it to Abaya. How she got them, we don't know. We could imagine, but whatever the case, she brought them to Abaya, wanted to sell them. Omala, so Abaya tells her, Yahavasli Resh Resh Batamri, will you give me each resh, meaning each pair of tefillin, which contains a shol rosh and a shol yad, will you give them to me for a date? So he's offering her a very cheap price for it. One date for each pair of tefillin. Imalya Zihara, she got angry. Shakla, she took the whole bag, she disinu benara and threw it into the river. Omar, so Abaya realizes, Loy Boyle, the Zalzalunu ba'apa kolahai, I shouldn't have treated it so casually in front of her and offered her such a low price, because yeah, that made her just throw it away. Now, with that said, of course, it depends on the circumstances. You have in our times, Chanuch Teller, the famous writer, tells a story of a yid one day in a store. Goy walks in with a pair of tefillin and offers them for sale. Obviously, he stole them from someplace, and the yid starts telling the goy, what do you mean? This is only half of it. Where's the other half? What you're giving me is not even really worth much. I'll give you $5 for it. And then, fine, the guy is willing to part with it for $5. So obviously, it depends on the circumstances. But in this case, I guess with some people, you can get away with it. But anyway, there is a fascinating explanation, though, from Rav Yitzchak, the Rebbe's father, who talks about the Kabbalah behind the story over here. He says, for one thing, why was it Dafka an Arab lady? And why Dafka to Abaya? And why is he offering a date? And so forth. There's a lot of nuances in the story that he says we need to understand. And he explains at some length over there that this Arab lady being descended from Ishmael represents chesed of klipa. And he talks about in some detail how tefillin in general we find in the Zohar, and we find it's brought extensively in the Siddurim Dach, that the tefillin, especially the tefillin Shal Rosh, represent the four compartments of it represent Chochma, Bina, Chesed, and Gvura. And he explains how the whole story fits with that. He says, in fact, in other words, this chaisa, it says that she brought them in a small bag. The word chais, first of all, it suggests the bag that inside the head that the brain is in, representing tefillin, that go above the brain on the head. And second of all, he says the word chaisa is actually the gematria of those four spheres together. Chochma, Bina, Chesed, Gvura. You add it all up, it equals the gematria of the word chaisa. So therefore, so on a deeper level, we're saying she's offering him that. So Abaya, and goes on to say, Abaya himself represents Chochmah and Bina, he represents these four spheres, and he shows how the name Abaya represents those, and he's offering, so that's why she came and offered them Dafka to him. He being a representative of Vura, as we had before in the story of Gidol Bar Eli and the get that he wanted to give to his wife, and he said, Baruch Atah Va Meitiv. So Reb Levick explains over there that Nair and other things, we see that Abaya is the representative of Gvura. He wants to offer her Tamri. Now, on the one hand, he says those have a certain connection with Tefillin, and he explains how the word Tamri relates to Tefillin. Among others, the Resh and the Yud represent Rosh and Yad. and then several other connections. On the other hand, though, Tmarim dates, also he explains, represent a very strong, harsh kind of gvura. So she's saying, "What you're offering me is gvura. Here I'm trying to sweeten gvura by offering you these tefillin, and you're instead telling me you want to put even harsher gvura." So she takes it and throws it into the river, and so Abaya realizes that he should have said something more clearly to make it clear that Itaka wants to redeem these tefillin and bring them back to Kedusha, rather than that doing something like this that could be misconstrued as he wants to impose even harsher gvuras. So he explains the whole thing very fascinatingly, Api Kabbalah. Yeah, it really is. You know, when we talk about the Torah Chadasha of Mashiach's times, I think part of it is going to be these kinds of things where you learn something from a Blavik and you understand the Gemara in a whole new way that you would never even have thought of before. Yeah. Okay, everyone.